Here with us to discuss the validity of the Montreal Cognitive Assessment in a diverse population in greater detail is lead author Dr. Marnina Stimmel. Marnina is a clinical neuropsychologist in the Division of Neuropsychology in the Department of Neurology at the Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx, New York. Marnina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So let's start off first with your telling us what's wrong with the Montreal Cognitive Assessment. In other words, what made you decide to test its validity?
So this work was really born out of clinical observation that the MoCA, it wasn't always accurate at identifying cognitive decline in some of the older adults that we were seeing in our memory and dementia center. So we would be getting referrals from the primary care physicians for dementia workup because they saw what they would call a low MoCA score based on the original cut points. But then we would find that the individual was likely performing at or close to their best.
And was there a specific population in your clinical work that made you suspicious that the MoCA wasn't really accurate?
Absolutely. So again, we work in the Bronx, New York, and in other areas in the New York area. And so our population is certainly made up of a diverse clientele. And so when we were seeing folks that either were not primarily from the United States or had a limited education, the MoCA seemed to be a little less effective at the cut points that are suggested.
And with reference to the study that we summarized before this interview began, tell me about the ethno-cultural and linguistic makeup of the population you studied.
Sure. And this is really important to consider when we're thinking about the application of this work. So our study came from a community clinic in Bronx, New York at Montefiore Medical Center. And like I said, it's a very diverse population, both in terms of racial and cultural makeup, and also in terms of linguistics. So in our final sample of 231 older adults, 42% of individuals self-identified as Hispanic, and 39% identified as non-Hispanic, Black, or African American. And a portion of those were folks who grew up and were educated outside of the United States. Linguistically, we only included folks that were completing the MoCA in either Spanish or English, but a little over 50% of our sample was primarily Spanish-speaking and really from a variety of Hispanic backgrounds. So, you know, majority from Puerto Rico and Dominican heritage, but also several other backgrounds as well.
And they had the option to take the test in Spanish, correct?
They were able to choose where they wanted it in Spanish or English, but the majority of folks who spoke Spanish chose to take it in Spanish. I think only 4 individuals chose to take it in English.
And Marnina, describe for me the neuropsychological measures that you administered to your study participants in addition to the MoCA.
So we included a broad range of neuropsychological measures to help us make accurate cognitive diagnoses. So these measures included tasks of word reading, which helped us evaluate premorbid functioning, which means, you know, how we think someone would have done at their best. We also included tasks of list learning and memory, picture naming, verbal fluency, speed of processing, and a clock drawing task, which can help us evaluate visuospatial and executive functioning. So in addition to these cognitive measures, we also included questionnaires that looked at mood and activities of daily living. So really, all in all, I'd say it's a pretty comprehensive neuropsychological evaluation for an older adult, especially in the research setting.
And just to clarify, a neuropsychological evaluation is different, more comprehensive than the MoCA.
Yeah, so I would just say that the MoCA is, you know, a brief measure. It's a screening tool. It's really not neuropsychological assessment. And it takes about 10 minutes to administer as opposed to comprehensive neuropsychological testing, which is much more expensive.
And how long does that take to administer?
So it can really vary. I'd say for older adults, it generally is under 2 hours, but it can be much more extensive depending on the patient population and the referral question.
So getting back to the article in which you were the lead author, I was struck by MoCA's gross underdiagnosis of normal cognition, and it's really alarming overdiagnosis of dementia compared to gold standard testing that you just described in this diverse and urban study population. So MoCA identified 10% of the patients as cognitively normal, whereas neuropsychological assessment identified about 40% as normal, and MoCA identified 38% as having dementia. That's a huge number, whereas neuropsychological assessment identified about 3%. That's 3% versus 38% as having dementia. So in my mind, that level of miscategorization can really lead to a variety of serious adverse issues for the individual patient as well as for the healthcare systems and the communities at large. So tell me, what do you see as the range of negative consequences of MoCA misdiagnoses? And I would ask you to categorize them from the most serious to the less serious.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I think you touched on some of it just now. When it comes to the healthcare system, you know, we know that there's often limited access to subspecialty resources like cognitive neurology or geriatrics or neuropsychology. And so we don't want to potentially overburden the system with referrals, which may not be appropriate. And of course, when that does happen, it generally leads to longer wait times for those patients that really do need timely services. And so that can really become problematic for those folks. And then, of course, at the individual level, giving that incorrect diagnosis of, let's say, dementia based on just this screening tool, it can cause some unnecessary distress to patients and their families.
Yeah, and it was surprising that even with the one-point education correction and a MoCA cut point of 23, there were still worryingly high rates of false positives. I'm sure primary care providers who are listening now are concerned. How should primary care providers use these data when they consider administrating MoCA to their various patients? And if you would, draw a distinction between multicultural patient populations and monocultural ones.
So I think our message for the primary care clinicians is to always take into account the individual patient sitting in front of us, and even more so when we're using cognitive screening tools such as the MoCA, which can be so heavily influenced by educational and cultural and linguistic factors. And that's true in both monocultural and multicultural patient populations. So our data really highlights the importance of asking the question, well, we see this number on the MoCA, but is this performance a change for the individual? And so we don't want to underplay things like educational and cultural influences. So if you hear something, for example, like name as many category items as fast as you can, that works in our culture where we're taught to value speed, but in other cultures where speed is less valued and they turn more towards accuracy, that's not going to mean quite the same thing. And, you know, I would also point out that previous researchers have identified that there are items on the MoCA that really aren't educationally or culturally fair to groups. So I think a clinician reviewing a lower MoCA score, they might want to look at the items that were wrong. So, for example, the drawing of an analog clock. It may not have that same automaticity in someone who didn't complete high school or who never worked an office job as it would in someone who worked every day as a teacher. And so that's why I think a score of 23 on the MoCA should mean something very different for a monolingual English-speaking retired lawyer who grew up in the U.S. as compared to an individual who moved to the U.S. from the Dominican Republic in their 60s and maybe completed elementary school but never worked outside the home.
Yeah, and talking about an analog clock for Gen Zers and millennials who basically have been digital from an early age, analog clocks are not familiar to them.
That's true. And I mean, we know that the MoCA is not necessarily used in folks going down that age range, but it's something that we are certainly thinking about in neuropsychology at large. Absolutely.
Yeah, well, I was thinking about when these Gen Zers and millennials get older.
Exactly.
The MoCA is going to have to change, right?
That's definitely true.
Changing with the changing culture. So tell me, in what patient populations can MoCA scores at current cut points be trusted as being an accurate cognitive screening tool?
You know, I'd say that's a tough question to answer. We know that the population that the MoCA was originally tested in included a sample of older adults with close to high school or greater education. And it has since been validated quite widely in various population and in languages. And I would say that you can actually find a lot of literature on the MoCA website, which could be helpful to that. And I will also point out the really great work done by Milani and colleagues, published in 2018, where they found that there were, in fact, different optimal cut points in the United States, depending on racial and ethnic groups. They were able to demonstrate that the current cut points that are available based on the publisher, they were appropriate in their non-Hispanic white group. But even they point out that regardless of group, even in that group, the optimal cut points appear to decrease when years of education decrease. You know, it's more complicated than just race and ethnicity.
Yeah, this is really a critical issue, and your data are so important given that there are limited resources for cognitive and memory care within our healthcare system. I certainly can see a scenario where meager resources are being diverted from patients who have real need to those who don't have a legitimate indication for them. Any parting advice that you can give to clinicians about the utility and validity of MoCA?
Yeah, definitely. I think a few things. I would say that while the MoCA is a great tool, and we did find that to be the case as well, even with our lowered cut points, it's a screening tool. And a single score doesn't make a diagnosis. So we really have to consider it as just one data point and just one of several things that needs to be considered when you're making your clinical decision of referring patients for further care. One question to always consider alongside the MoCA score is whether the patient and or their loved one, are they reporting cognitive changes and especially changes in their day-to-day functioning, right? Are they having trouble with paying their bills or taking their medications or with cooking? And more importantly, are those a change for them, right? Perhaps they never paid the bills or they've always struggled with their IADLs. And so maybe that lower MoCA score is just tapping into some lifelong difficulty rather than a cognitive decline. And, I would actually say that the primary care physicians are lucky because they're really well situated to get to know their patients over time. So they are ideal in identifying subtle changes that need further workup. So we've already highlighted, in this talk, the need to consider education and cultural background and language. But for a clinician, I think, who's still really on the fence, even after all that, they might want to consider tracking their patient over time. So perhaps repeating the MoCA in 6 or 12 months and also taking into account their own clinical observations. So by tracking patients, I think the clinician can see whether there's stability or decline on the MoCA and in the patient's functioning based on their observation. And I think those pieces together can really be informative and assist in their clinical decision-making.
Well, that's great advice. And of course, in any clinical situation, listening to your patients and to your patients' families, that's really key to understanding the patient, in addition to all the other great tips you offered us. Marnina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.